At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As it was in the beginning, goes the great old prayer, and you could sing it for the digital age. Its dawn was in the cauldron of Nazi threat and nuclear war. Its first iteration was born in fevered urgency. Its big ideas are the bedrock of the world we live in now, the foundation. Historian George Dyson has brought it all back to help us understand the birth of the digital age and where we stand now. This hour On Point, the birth of the digital universe and where we're headed. Joining me now in the studio is celebrated science historian George Dyson, son of Freeman Dyson, who was there as magician and quantum physicist, brother of Esther Dyson, digital guru and investor, author of the big new book, Turing's Cathedral, The Origins of the Digital Universe. George Dyson, welcome to On Point. It's wonderful to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be in Boston, where so much of this technology came from.
Well, look at that. Why is it important? We're going to dive into it. It's an incredible story. But why is it important for us to bear in mind, as we live in this exploding digital universe even now, the origins of this world?
Well, it is important to know where we are and where we came from. And my primary viewpoint is to remember the small groups of people who made this happen, who were sort of losing the last of the eyewitnesses, and I wanted to record sort of one part of that story so that as we go into the next stage, we remember the beginning.
That story and the big ideas, the concepts kind of embedded in it that still in many ways surround us now. Take us back to this. I mean, this is really interesting. You think of computers and, punch cards and all the rest. It can sound kind of dry, but you remind us vividly this really was born out of the era of Nazi threat and code breakers and then the race for nuclear weapons. How?
Yes. Well, I mean, and it was born out of the world of analog electronics that were pushed.
Vacuum tubes.
Vacuum tubes, cathode ray tubes, if you remember such a thing. It's hard to find one now. Mm-hmm. You used to be able to not go 10 feet without running
right.
into
Every
one.
Junkyard was full of them for a while there.
Yes.
And now everything falls apart.
And somehow these very brilliant engineers primarily put that together and made it work in a digital way. And I'm less interested in the endless argument over which computer was first. Mm-hmm. We'll never answer that. I mean, mm-hmm. really, digital computing begins with counting on your fingers. Mm-hmm. And more interested in the question of how did this address matrix begin in which we now live? And we take it for granted that you key in a website and that's translated into a number that translates to an address, and you get back all these strings of code. Sort of where did that begin?
We live in that matrix, and we'll look at that. Take us to the circumstances that propelled the thinking and then the actual building of these first computers, to the time of Turing, who you put at the very title of your book, to the time of von Neumann, code-breaking, nuclear weapons.
Yeah, so it looks to us as if digital computing sort of suddenly flowered at the end of World War II. It just suddenly appears in a span of a year. Mm-hmm. Actually, modern digital computing had been incubating during the war in a number of secret projects. And after the war, those projects, to varying degrees, were opened up. And suddenly there was this cross-fertilization between ideas, and we ended up with essentially the digital universe we live in.
That unopened can had Alan Turing in it, and he was part of the British code breakers in World War II. What was the challenge they were up against? Why did it take them to the notion of a computer?
It was a life and death matter for England. We have to remember that England was an island, getting all their supplies in by ship, and a lot of those ships were being sunk by German submarines. It was a tremendous arms race between the submarines learning where the ships were and mm-hmm. the ships learning where the submarines were. And the Germans' high command was communicating with the submarines through radio communications, which mm-hmm. were being intercepted, and they were being sent in digital code. So suddenly, these very oddball mathematicians who had not been considered of any importance before the war, where it was suddenly a life or death matter to decode these digitally encoded messages.
And to make machines capable of sorting through that huge volume and figuring out what it all meant. Did they understand that this was a mathematics problem at heart immediately?
Oh, yes. I mean, immediately all the bright young mathematicians in England started disappearing and going to work on this problem the same way our bright young people here in America disappeared to Los Alamos.
Turing understood that he was a brilliant mathematician. He understood that you needed, well, he envisioned computers doing this. And what did that mean? This was different from just a calculator. What was he thinking of?
Well, he had this very clear vision long before the war in 1935 to prove a mathematical point. He demonstrated how if you built one computer, you only had to build one digital computer, and then you could encode instructions that would imitate the behavior of any other computer. And this seemed very abstract. He was just trying to solve a problem in logic. But that was what was needed to break these codes. So what the British did was build some very fast machines that could be essentially reprogrammed over and over again at very, very high speed to search for the keys to these code. So they built what we now call a Turing machine and did this, very fast and very successfully.
Part of what really mattered here was in Turing's conception, and it leads to you ultimately talking about computers in almost biological terms, that Turing envisioned, wrote codes that were constantly improving themselves.
Yes, I mean, that came a little bit later, mm-hmm. but what they had to do in the war was make codes that varied. I mean, so the permutation of the one machine went through an enormous number of variations, and then if you were lucky, you would hit on the one, following some very clever clues that mm-hmm. then gave you an imitation of the machine that the Germans were using to encode the messages.
So you had the key to the code.
Yes, you sort of knew what the state of the enemy machine was, and then you could decode the messages. So and of course this had to be done under, if it took you 36 hours, it was too late. This sort of had to be done in 24 hours or less. You sort of needed the next day's instructions to the U-boat fleet.
So there was the fire, the urgency here in the U.S., you remind us. I mean, they were designing computers to help with artillery tables and, to fire the artillery shells more accurately, huge, with 10 or 20 people actually working inside these computers, feeding punch cards and paper strips and early forms of software.
Yeah, we had one big computer, the ENIAC, during the war. The British, they actually replicated this machine they built called the Colossus. And our machine was very powerful in a somewhat different way. And the important thing was that towards the end of the war, it was realized how that machine could be made even more versatile, and I believe very strongly that Alan Turing contributed directly to that transformation. That his ideas had a direct input into what we did here.
You turn from Turing to John von Neumann, huge figure in the American effort on this, and you describe how, with the war's end, and of course it ended in Japan with the dropping of nuclear weapons, and then immediately the race on to get the more powerful hydrogen bomb from the A-bomb. What was it about that effort that required, once again, an urgent effort on the computing front?
Right. Well, John von Neumann, who was mm-hmm. Hungarian, mm-hmm. young refugee, came to America
came early.
In 1930, ahead mm-hmm. of the sort of exodus of refugee scientists. And ended up being involved with all the aspects of the war effort. You have to remember that, mm-hmm. that these Hungarians lost most of their families in the Holocaust mm-hmm. and felt they were
driven,
very determined that, mm-hmm. that the most powerful weapons should be on our side. Mm-hmm. And you also have to remember that von Neumann, even from the beginning, was more worried about the Russians than the Germans. And that during the war in Los Alamos, when most of the people working on the fission bomb, on the bombs that we dropped on Japan, he was already working on the hydrogen bomb problem, the bomb that would be 1,000 times more powerful. Mm-hmm. And he was working with a scientist named Klaus Fuchs. They were collaborating mm-hmm. very strongly. And then it turned out Klaus Fuchs was the Russian spy. Mm-hmm. So from von Neumann's point of view, the Russians already knew everything we knew. And the race was on. That's why there was this terrible, like the code-breaking time pressure, to find out whether a hydrogen bomb would work or not. And you, at that point, you couldn't build one and try it out. It was so that's the origins of the idea that you would model it numerically. So
and that required computing, computer power.
It not only required computing power, it required, in a way, this digital matrix that we ended up with. I mean, it sort of required an artificial numerical universe in which to run these simulations of the problems, which were primarily hydrodynamic codes. And they figured out how to run that on the ENIAC, which was quite extraordinary, that this machine that had been built for something else was actually used to run these codes. The answer they got was wrong, it turned out.
The bomb, when they finally exploded, was far more powerful than they had anticipated.
Yes, and built in a very different way. So what they were doing right after the war, they were sort of on the wrong path in terms of the physics, but they were absolutely on the right path in terms of the computation.
You described this scene. It was at Princeton in those days, a five-year sort of just hell-for-leather effort to get this thing done as this race was on. It's really a riveting story. And the ideas, the conception, the basic structure, the digital matrix. Here's the sound of that first hydrogen bomb test. This was November 1st, 1952. The U.S. military detonated the first hydrogen bomb on the uninhabited atoll that they used in the Marshall Islands. Scientists predicted that the blast would be 3 to 4 megatons. They miscalculated badly. The test, codenamed Ivy Mike, was 14 megatons, produced a fireball 3.5 miles wide, vaporized the island.
Minus 10 seconds. Niner, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, T0.
There had been an urgent race on, of course, there, and right in the heart of that, the drive to build the computer. About a decade later, engineers at Bell Labs programmed the IBM 7090 vacuum tube mainframe computer to sing the song Daisy Bell. The machines then cost $2.9 million each, were also used by NASA to control the Gemini and Mercury space flights. Here's the first singing computer. Science historian George Dyson is with me in the studio, and we're looking earlier. George, you mentioned a couple of times the digital matrix and that sort of conceptual breakthrough that allowed computing as we know it to happen. What was that conceptual breakthrough?
Well, we had computers before then. We had electronic computers before then. We had electronic digital computers. We even had electronic stored program digital computers. But the memory was essentially one-dimensional. It sort of followed Turing's model of a one-dimensional tape. And what the von Neumann group did that other groups would have done if they hadn't. So they sort of developed a model that was copied. They made the memory two-dimensional. They went from sort of a one-dimensional model to a two-dimensional matrix like a chessboard where you pick a square on the chessboard and in that square is a 40-bit string of code. And that was, in many ways, sort of the origin of this explosion that you put in 10 bits for an address and 10 bits for an instruction, and you do something to it, you get back a 40-bit string. So it's like 1 plus 1 equals 4 rather than 1 plus 1 equals 2. And
you said think about it like a 40-story hotel maybe where
exactly,
you've got information stored in every room and off you go and back it comes.
Right. You want all the bits in that location. And it never stopped. I mean, that's really why we live in this world where every year you can buy a USB stick that's twice as big for half the cost. It's just sort of the numbers are out there replicating in a way, looking for homes, and we're doing our best to keep up with it.
When it was von Neumann and Niels Barcelli and that whole gang, did they know what they were up to? Did they know what they were on to?
Some of them did. I mean, I spoke with a few of the survivors, and there were quite a number, because the importance of this was realized, and there were oral histories done while many of the people were still alive. And And a number of them were, I think, fully aware, particularly Niels Barrichelli, of where this would go. And I think von Neumann was, but he didn't.
He was a biologist.
He was a viral geneticist. He was like the perfect guy at the right time. Here's a guy who's studying. And you have to remember, he starts this in 1951, before we determined the sort of digital structure of DNA. And he in a way, foresaw it all. And so he was there running digital codes in the memory of this computer trying to imitate, you know, biological genetic evolution at the very moment at which we discovered how it was done in biology.
Explain that for us. Why a background in viral genetics, or that biological way of looking at the world, was so important in this very dawn of computing, the digital
age?
Well,
it turned out, I mean, as we discovered in 1953 with what Watson and Crick and Rosalind Franklin mm-hmm. did, that we determined how life is sort of repeating itself through a digitally coded stage. That's what DNA does. It's sort of an mm-hmm. error correction process. And so if you could simplify this and say that the biologists were trying to decode the digital nature of life. And in the other direction, Niels Barrichelli was trying to encode the life into a digital computer. So they were sort of working at the same problem from absolutely opposite directions, and they intersected in 1953 at this very important moment.
That origin turns out to be consequential. I mean, you look out on this whole sweep of time now and the development since then, the digital evolution since then, and you see, as I read you, a kind of biological dynamic at work in our computers.
Yes. I mean, the most, I mean, one of the true sort of interesting moments of this whole research process I got involved with to sort of dig out all these stories was I went back to this institute, which is not at Princeton University. They started work they were given a storage room next to the boiler room in the basement. Mm-hmm. And I went down there. It's always important to revisit the physical scene of something. So I go down to this.
I mean, you had been a kid in this area. You used to play around with the discarded parts in a barn outside that building.
And you weren't supposed to go in the basement where the boiler rooms were.
Yeah.
But anyway, I went down. I got permission to go down there. And it turned out that same storeroom where these guys had started building this, you know, plugged in their first soldering guns at the end of World War II to start this project. It's now the main, it was then the main server room for the Institute. And there's a fiber optic line coming in with 54 megabits per second. Now remember, their computer had a memory of 5 kilobytes.
Right.
And the engineer who gives me the tour, you know, there's a rack of machines and several racks, and the whole room is being cooled to keep it cool. And one of these big, powerful servers, all it is doing is watching this 54 megabits per second traffic looking for self-replicating strings of code. I mean, now we call them viruses, mm-hmm. and trying to keep them out. In the place where Barrichelli was working so hard to try and evolve self-replicating strings of digital code, we now live in a world where they're out there in the wild trying to get back in. And I thought that was a very profound sort of demonstration of what's happened in this 60 years. I mean, it's just moved so far.
It's incredible. It was such an intense effort at that time that you described. I mean, this band of scientists and engineers, Julian Bigelow in there with all the vacuum tubes and everything else, just working night and day, really, 5 years. I mean, the urgency was so high. Von Neumann's wife, Clary, right in there, writing code.
Right, yes, and ending up in the hospital because she didn't get any sleep. And the sobering thing to me is that this small group of people, and I'd be the first to say there were other groups of people at many other laboratories in the world doing just as good work. This happened mm-hmm. to be the one that was successful. We can talk about why. They did this entire project with about 12 people and $1 million in less time than it took me to write about it.
It's amazing. That is amazing. Now, either they're very fast or you're slow. There were more of them.
I'm slow.
You know, I was also struck talking about how things developed after and why. One big distinction was in the UK, where this had begun with Alan Turing, your Turing's Cathedral, all of this work was kept secret after the war, whereas in the U.S. it was turned out. It was made much more public, and I mean, the way I read what you describe here, that's almost the reason that the U.S. moved into the forefront. Lots of people dived in on this, and we became the great global computing power.
Yeah, I mean, it's why the poor people in England have to suffer Microsoft Windows. And, I mean, in a very direct way, that the sort of IBM, you know, architecture took over the world, and that was directly attributable to this. We weren't supposed to know it, but von Neumann was actually consulting for IBM since 1945. So they were getting all the, and to his credit, it was freely available. I mean, there were no patent restrictions, and everything was openly published as soon as it was developed. Very different world than we live in today.
When you look at, speaking of the world today, when you look at it, and if you imagine von Neumann and Turing, for that matter, he had a sad end, we'll talk about it, but if they could see where things are now, what do you think they would think of the world that's come from their code-breaking, nuclear weapons-gauging, frenzied effort all those decades ago?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question, and it's not that out of line because, you know, Alan Turing would be 100 this mm-hmm. year. He could easily have lived into the 1980s, 1990s, most of his colleagues did. There's still colleagues of his alive. And I think there would be two reactions. If you brought Alan Turing and John von Neumann into, you know, a modern computing environment, it would take them about 10 minutes to completely figure out what was going on. It would be no mystery to them.
Because the conceptual foundations would be recognizable to them.
Yes, and they would be, I think, number one, absolutely astonished at the amount of computing we have. The fact that you know, in my bag right there is a machine. When you do the numbers, it's like 200 billion times as powerful as what they had, and it's just sitting there waiting for me to, you know, go check my email later.
Talk about miscalculating the hydrogen bomb. Here's orders of magnitude on the computing power.
Inconceivable, and that they are all connected into this network. Mm-hmm. That would absolutely amaze them. And the other thing that would amaze them is that we are using their machine. I mean, they did this, particularly Julian Bigelow was very unhappy with the way they built this computer. He wanted desperately to, you know, to build a new one differently. And any of them, I think, would have said, well, in 2 or 3 years, we'll have completely different, better computers. And here we are, effectively exactly following the same blueprint that they
established. Now, what do you mean when you say that? What is it that we're using? We're not using that same sort of, what was it, 8-foot box?
No, but the logical architecture of it is really exactly the same from the point of view of the way the bits move around and the way we address them and the way we, from the point of view of the order codes and the instructions, it's sort of like it's what happened to life, that we, you know, in a modern organism, you find sequences mm-hmm. of nucleotides that evolved
trilobites
3 billion years ago. Yeah. Nothing's changed. Once the world becomes comfortable, the organisms preserve the world in, you know, the way it was when they were born. The same way, you know, our blood is the same salinity as the ocean was when life began.
But in this case, this was made by humans. We could have done it differently, I suppose. How does that, you know, if we have the same logical architecture today, looking back on it, your view or those of other computer scientists, they say, yeah, thank heavens that they used that logical architecture because that set us up optimally, or could we have done better?
I think it was just sort of an accident of history that we copied this architecture, and once it became copied, it was copied more and more until now we, you know, when I checked a few months ago, you know, it was expanding by 5 trillion bits per second.
But is it optimal, what we inherited from the history you describe, or might we have laid a better foundation?
I think it's not optimal, and we could certainly have done it different ways, but it's just become so cheap. It's so prolific. There's no reason to change. And then there's this vicious circle where you, you know, as you all know, when you build a new computer, if you want to sell it in the market, it has to be able to run the old software. And if you write new software, it has to be able to run on the existing machine. So it's very difficult to change.
Describe an alternative foundation that our digital age might sit on. Is that possible? This one's not optimal, so what? How might it have been different, and where would that have put us?
That gets quite, probably too technical, but to talk about different memory architectures or more efficient ways. I mean, our computers are probably, you know, the least efficient machines ever built. I mean, we use
even now with all the advances, because of the basic architecture you're saying.
Right, that 99.99% of the machine is idle at any given time. But
dreaming, I think you described
that
idleness.
But it just is so fast that it doesn't matter, that you get enough done in the time that it is working. And it's a, you know, it just works so well. Now we think some of the newer developments like, you know, cloud computing and so on are actually, if you look at them in a very broad way, they are ways of sort of, you know, finding loopholes in the architecture to actually use the existing machines
more efficiently.
Mm-hmm. And that's why those ideas are successful.
George Dyson is with us. His new book is Turing's Cathedral, The Origins of the Digital Universe. And, George, we have a lot of callers patiently waiting here. Mildred in Bristol, Rhode Island. Mildred, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air with George Dyson.
Hello?
Hello, Mildred. You're on.
Hi. I can hardly hear you. If you can hear me.
Yes, loud and clear. No problem.
I can hear you.
Okay, great. Our family covers really the speaking of history. I'm 81, and when my father came to Detroit in 1923, he got a job at Burroughs Adding Machine Company, making typewriters and adding machines. And then when I went to college at Wayne State University, I had a friend, Joe Weizenbaum, who was a math major. And one day he came, about around 1950, the early 50s, and he said, you know, I saw the most amazing thing at Burroughs today. It was a big room. They had a big room with all these people putting these vacuum tubes in and out, and it was just amazing. They solved a problem for the Navy on the right shape of bow for a ship, and, us English majors couldn't figure out how anybody could do anything like that. And then later on, Joe went on to get his doctorate at MIT, and he taught there for the rest of his teaching career, and then retired and just died a couple of years ago. But my father would be absolutely stunned to know. And he ended up making computers. And they changed the name to Unisys.
So, Mildred, are you on a computer these days? Are you on your iPhone?
Are you kidding? I'm on my fifth computer. I have an iPhone. I have all the stuff. And my kids. And, you know, I mean, it has really, what it has done for us is to broaden the world. I'm in contact with my kids all the time. I sell on eBay, and I talk to people all around the world.
Mildred, our time is short before the break, but at 81, your life encompasses a lot of the history George describes, all of it.
And I've met Joe Weizenbaum, and actually what very little programming I know, I learned on a Burroughs computer. Burroughs built extremely good machines. It's a whole other thread in the story.
Mildred, I so appreciate your call. I mean, I'm sure these days you could find many families with stories. I mean, your family has this story, George.
No, not as directly as that.
No, not as directly, but kind of enmeshed in the science and times of computers, some people like Mildred's in their very development that brought us to this point in what you describe as a still exploding digital universe. George Dyson's new book is Turing's Cathedral. I'm Tom Ashbrook here in the studio with George Dyson. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the first computers, the birth of the digital age, the original vision, and where we stand now. Here's a little bit of... this is a CBS television commercial from the early 1950s, just after some of the work that George Dyson has described, and is talking about the Remington Rand Company's Universal Automatic Computer, or UNIVAC, and what it might be able to do.
The hero of our story tonight is the giant electronic brain developed by Remington Rand, UNIVAC. Now, recent experiments show that future use of UNIVAC may give us faster and more accurate weather predictions than were ever possible before. You see, UNIVAC can take the past histories of thousands and thousands of storms, analyze them, compare them with developing conditions, and make predictions, all in a matter of minutes. Calculations that would ordinarily take hundreds of man hours to complete.
There in the 1950s, working to envision the future. And hear a little sound of that life today. Here's an ad for the new iPhone 4S featuring Apple's digital personal assistant, Siri.
What's my day look like? Not bad. Only two meetings today.
Can I walk to the Belvedere Hotel from here?
Here are directions to Belvedere Hotel.
Bring me that text.
And off goes Siri with the human interaction right there. George Dyson, you pay a lot of attention to the human interaction, where we're headed here. You describe the move from analog to digital, but you say in some ways today, with the kind of systems that we're using and functions we're using, we're bringing analog back in. This is also kind of a biological, talk about biological, we become the biological part of this new analog reintegration.
Yes, I think very much so.
What is that? Like what?
And first of all, I'll say one thing about that clip that
Remington
Rand, the chairman of computing at Remington Rand, was General Leslie Groves, who had been the director of Los Alamos. It was a direct lineage.
So there you go, right from the nuclear push to the digital computer push.
Right, when Leslie Groves retired from the Army and decided what to do, he became vice president of Remington Rand.
And there was lots of that integration of minds from that military effort into America's industrial effort.
Very close, yeah. So, yeah, I'm sort of on dangerous ground. Nobody wants to talk about analog computing. I mean, we think it's just of historical interest only. Sort of it's disappeared with the dinosaurs, mm-hmm. Back with the vinyl records and vacuum tubes. Mm-hmm. But in my view, if you look at the world of computing today, we're actually going, in a lot of ways, going back to analog computing, and it's very successful. Just nobody mentions the word. It's not an appropriate word to use.
It doesn't look that way. Feel that way. The way we think about it, we think about the iPhone in our hands or lots of other digital devices. Where's the analog component?
Right. I mean, we're doing it with digital, on a digital substrate. But the if you look at good examples of the way Facebook works, I mean, in a way, Facebook is an analog computer, that these maps of human relationships are almost infinitely complex. If you even take a small high school and try and write a digital code that keeps track of who's dating whom and who's friends mm-hmm. and who's not, and it changes every minute. And the code would become hugely complex. And sort of the Facebook approach is you write a very simple digital code, you give it to everyone, everyone joins Facebook, and then they sort those relationships out for themselves. And the whole network, I mean, the whole Facebook as an organization essentially becomes an analog computer.
That, so we're the analog element, in effect.
The way to just sort of describe it more technically is mm-hmm. that the complexity is not in the code; it's in the topology, in the shape. The network becomes a model of itself, a mm-hmm. working model. Mm-hmm. And that's a very good way to solve some of these very difficult problems, like who's friends with whom at any given moment.
Is that a kind of merger going on?
I mean, we call it Web 2.0 and things like that.
But I guess I mean human machine merger.
Yeah, it's very effective. I mean, instead of trying to build some separate model of the way, kids at Harvard have their relationships, you just let it become a model of itself, and that's if you look at weather prediction or something, mm-hmm. essentially the atmosphere is a model of itself, mm-hmm. and the job of the people trying to code that into computers is to somehow make that work digitally, but you can actually make it work more easily and more powerfully in an analog way. And Google is doing very much the same thing
with search.
Yes, and with it's easy to collect all the information, but it's very hard to identify where the meaning and the meaning is in the connections. And every time we click on a link, we are establishing a where the meaning is in a very analog way.
You describe this in some ways as the computers, the digital world, using us.
Well, they're learning, we're learning from each other. I mean, but in a way, yes. I mean, if you tried to build a machine that would learn, all the knowledge in a human mind, it's in a way, we're building a machine that's learning the knowledge in all human minds. I mean, every time we search for something, we are giving up a little bit of information of what is meaningful to us. Not so much when we search, but when we are given 100 results
mm-hmm.
and we choose the one that's supposed to be. And that information is conveyed back you know, as a slightly favorable weighting in the algorithms that were very cleverly written to keep track of this. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very powerful, clever system. It's in a ways it's what Alan Turing envisioned, because he later in his after his great work in 1936, he started to think about what he called oracle machines, which were deterministic only to a certain point, and then they took non-deterministic jumps into a different state, and that's what we are sort of
the human element.
Yeah, in a way, we are the non-deterministic mm-hmm. links in this otherwise deterministic machine. It's a very, very, it's a way to do computation that is not necessarily computable in the deterministic sense.
A listener, Dan, writes, asks, "Is it the rate of current technological advancement?" He's asking you here, George, how long do you think it will take before digital computing power mirrors that of the human brain?
You know, that's a question that I certainly wouldn't answer. I don't know the answer, and I think I think this question has been asked and repeatedly answered, and the answers are always wrong.
But is it even imaginable, or is it sort of asymptotically approaching that but never can?
It's imaginable, but the human brain is almost unimaginably complex, and I think particularly physicists, have a way of underestimating the complexity of biology, and so this question. Nor even if you said at which point does the network become as complex as a human brain, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. I mean, one human brain doesn't get you anywhere. I mean, human brain gets you somewhere when you have a whole culture of human beings and a language and a civilization and all these things that lead to. The human mind just doesn't exist in a vacuum.
So. But which has greater access to that organism, individual humans or Google?
Well, that's where the two systems are being integrated in a very interesting way. That in a way, Google is a system that is doing what we call machine learning, and learning the way that the way the human mind works, but in a very different way than just building one machine and trying to program it.
I mean, you've said, remember the real truth behind Google Books, for example. All those books are being scanned by Google, not for us to read them, but for the artificial intelligence to use them, mine them, I guess.
Yeah, not in any sinister way, the sense that
to learn.
That we are building this collective human knowledge and making it, I mean, in a way that it was H.G. Wells who really envisioned that best, that just the entire human memory of the whole species would become available to anyone at any time, and here we are. It's pretty much true, and that's a very interesting world.
Pretty amazing. George Dyson's new book is Turing's Cathedral. Let's go to our listeners. William in Gloucester, Massachusetts. William, thank you for calling. You're on the air with George Dyson.
Hello, Tom. Hello, George.
Hi.
This has been so fascinating. I'm wondering if your guest is familiar with the Mark I Able computer that was developed for naval vessels.
Yes, but not intimately familiar. I mean, I know of its existence as, so many other computers, but it's not something that I devoted any time to understanding or talking to people who worked on it or anything.
What's your connection with it, William?
I went into the Navy in the early 60s, and it was the most fascinating time because it was a time where the Mark I Able was an analog electromechanical computer used for computing gun trajectories on the ship. And at the same time, there were other systems that were using the first diodes, and then not too long after that, the first integrated circuit. So I got to see all of the technology growing in the development of these things.
Was this Vietnam, William, or what was the setting?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Vietnam era.
No, it's the missing link between the analog. You sort of saw the last of the analog and the first of the digital. That's you should write about that. It's a great, great, important period.
There's a window and a moment and a hinge. William, I'm glad to hear from you. Let me get one more. Will in Nashville, Tennessee. Will, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I can't wait to read this book. I think it's actually a very important history. And every time there's some good comprehensive computer history like this, I always try to devour it as much as I can. It's hard for kind of modern society to forget that it's not just Apple and Macintosh, you know, and versus Microsoft and how the software is where the money is. But I love the romance and the storytelling of the hardware.
There's a lot of hardware in this history. Let me tell you, it's pretty amazing stuff.
I can't wait to read that about the hardware, and it reminds me of when, you know, I got so excited when I was a kid and teenager about restoring old computers because it was the people who built them that fascinated me and the history of that. And
what question does it?
What, thank you.
What question does it bring to mind today, Will?
It brings to mind, especially about the inefficiency comments from earlier. I remember, you know, when RAM was hundreds of dollars to get to 1 megabyte of RAM, and now, you know, files are so big and so exhaustive and so large. I just keep thinking, when is it going to be too inefficient for speedy processors, and when are these programs going to replace our humanity as relational beings, you know, and when is it going to take the place of us having to have personal memory and us having to have personal responsibility in that way? I mean, do you think that's 20 years, 30 years?
It could be tomorrow or it could be never, but I think that's sort of up to us to make that decision, how much time you want to, you know, spend on Facebook or not.
Is it really up to us, or do we just kind of willy-nilly surrender some of that memory? As the computers pick it up and do it for us, we sort of lose that muscle. We rely on
tapping. It's hard. It's very hard not to be drawn in. But fundamentally, that to me is the question. Not so much are the machines becoming more intelligent, but are we, you know, do we relinquish our intelligence? The number to remember that I always can remember is in 1953 there were 53 kilobytes of high-speed random access memory on the entire planet. But what it means to us is a very good question, and I think that really is, it's up to the next generation. The children are going to, you know, are going to figure that out.
As we use, we decide we may turn around and find it figured out. One more, and Mike in Norwell, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air. Hello, Mike, are you there? Sounds as though we may have missed Mike.
Are you there?
Yes, Mike, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to back up a bit and look at this from a different perspective. This entire history points out the real indispensable function of government-funded research. And as we go forward these days, you know, we all sort of worship the market, but the market doesn't do any of the fundamental things that are required to develop something like computers or atomic power or atomic weapons or any of those things. And so, you know, you've been talking about the complexity of the human brain and the inefficiencies of the digital architecture. We will never get to the complexity of the human brain because the market only refines what is. It doesn't really come up with, you know, breakthrough, real new stuff.
Mike, our time is so short, but let me put that to George, because that is abundantly clear, the huge government investment in the root ball of this world.
That is true. Then now on the contrary side, I always try to be open-minded. I think it's certainly true that the government was extremely important to these developments. Now, on the other hand, there's a fabulous new book just came out, you know, a week after mine, called The Idea Lab, on what happened at Bell Labs, which is the opposite. There was private, you know, whether you are for or against AT&T as a monopoly at the time, they did, you know, this world owes as much to Bell Labs as to anything else. And so I think you need both, and they need to learn to work together.
There's a human story here, too, a sad end for Alan Turing. I mean, you talk about how he was persecuted as a homosexual and arrested and forcibly injected with estrogen and killed himself.
Well, no, we don't know that Turing killed himself.
Okay.
I think it's a mistake for people to assume that. He died of cyanide poisoning, but
many people do, though, do they not? I mean,
I haven't seen any
proof. You're
that
the boss.
Killed himself. So I think his mother doesn't think he killed himself.
Oh, good. All right. Forgive me then. Maybe that's just lore that's come down.
It is odd that we just take it for granted that it was suicide when there was never what would constitute today a proper determination.
Did the British government not know what they had in this mind, in this man?
They knew, and I think in a certain sense they may have been afraid of it, but that we really don't know. I mean, Turing had he was a difficult character. You don't want to make him into some saint, but boy, he was bright and had was ready to do a lot further work. I mean, that's why I find it hard to believe he committed suicide, because he just had so much that he still wanted to do.
We live in his cathedral today. George Dyson puts it right in the title of his big new book, Turing's Cathedral, The Origins of the Digital Universe. You can read an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. George Dyson, it's a privilege and an honor to have you with us today. Thank you so much for this history and your time with us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here, and I wish we had more time for questions.
Yeah, me too. They sure are. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.